BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Happy New Year and welcome to the Tuesday, the 13th of January edition of Dialect Radio. Well, our opening fortnight of 2009 has seen temperatures colder than Greenland, so to take our minds off that, we have a bit of a Gaza special. There's something going on there if you've been watching the news or reading the newspapers lately. We have a report from last week's Palestine Solidarity Demo in Bristol City Centre, and we hear from George Galloway, MP. We also have some exotic ruminations on the culture of the Incas from our own Anthea Page, who is in Peru. Jeff Sparks returns with his usual What's On guide and track of the week. All that and more coming up after this week's news roundup with Tony Gosling and his copy of The Private Eye.
Foreign Secretary David Miliband called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, and Gordon Brown stressed the need to stop the supply of arms to Hamas, the Foreign Office has been licensing increasing arms sales to Israel. These include just the kind of kit the Israeli Air Force needs for its bombardment of the Palestinians, components for combat aircraft and military aero engines, as well as parts for Israeli pilots, helmet-mounted display equipment. According to the latest Foreign Office figures, Britain exported 18,847,000 pounds worth of weapons to Israel in the first 3 months of 2008. This was a sharp increase compared to the 7.5 million of weapons sales to Israel in the whole of 2007. Every year, the nation's most venerable lefty journal, The New Statesman, marks the TUC Conference Week with a 32-page supplement celebrating trade unionism. But it seems rather keener on the theory than the practice. Since last May, as was reported in Private Eye 1219, hacks at the Staggers have been requesting official recognition for their chapel, the office branch of the National Union of Journalists, to which a large majority of them belong. Creepy New Statesman publisher Spencer Neal has now written to the hacks on behalf of the magazine's millionaire co-owners Jeffrey Paymaster Robinson and Mike Ted Danson, formally confirming that they refuse to recognise trade unions. The American-owned ITT Corporation has produced a gushing tender document in its hunt for a PR agency to puff its ethical credentials. The company wants to help spread the word about initiatives that boost its reputation for corporate responsibility. This includes supporting the company's signature philanthropy initiative, ITT Watermark, as well as communications activities in support of core corporate functions like environmental, health and safety, and inclusion and diversity. ITT's homepage and annual reports, meanwhile, offer heartwarming images of hunger relief initiatives and describe the firm as a diversified, high-technology engineering and manufacturing company dedicated to creating more livable environments, enabling communications and providing protection and safety. Its most prominent service is depicted as water management, and the green agenda is clearly extremely important. Less prominent, though, in the blurb is the fact that ITT's largest client is the US military, and that its products include missile parts and night vision goggles, which it sold to armed forces fighting the war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq, including £15 million worth to our own Ministry of Defence. And it's also coy about the fact that in 2007, ITT became the first major defence contractor to be convicted for criminal violation of the US Arms Export Control Act, for which it was fined $100 million. Does ITT ITT's need for a communications agency to promote the social responsibility of its war-waging products have anything to do with the looming change of US government? It will be interesting to see which PR firm snaps up the $500 million contract. York City Council have spent £40,000 on sat-nav systems to keep track of their dust carts and then allowed 8 of them to be stolen from unlocked vehicles. The London Borough of Richmond has consulted widely on planning matters, so widely that questionnaires were sent to addresses which included a bus shelter and a row of wheelie bins. And Wiltshire County Council have set up a website offering advice to pregnant 7 to 12-year-olds. That's it for this week's news roundup from Private Eye.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling. Last week saw the biggest demonstration and rally in support of Palestine yet seen in Bristol. 400 Bristolians marched around Bristol city centre, and afterwards, Farouk Sadiq from Bristol Muslim Cultural Society spoke about the censorship of his Evening Post column.
...by Lord TSB, and I said about how bad this was for the Palestinian people because Interpol is doing such good work for the Palestinians. The Evening Post refused to publish the column. In that week, there was no column.
Oh, shame!
Shame!
That week, there was no column from me as a Muslim in Bristol. The following week, Israel started bombing Gaza. This week I wrote about Gaza, the bombing of Gaza. And they published it. But online, as soon as that column went up, within 2 or 3 minutes, I was inundated with demands for the Evening Post to withdraw my column completely. They said I was supporting terrorism, I was supporting terrorists. I was giving a one-sided view. And I asked people, I said, look, if you agree with the column, write into the Evening Post. Over 60 people, people like yourself, wrote into the Evening Post to say how balanced the article was. Your comments were only on there for 2 days. If you go to the site now, all of the comments have been removed. Compare that to the other columnists, and their comments have been on there for months, and they have not been removed. The columnists, the comments about Gaza, about balancing the argument, about giving the history of Gaza, have all been removed off the website, right to the Evening Post. You've demonstrated here, you've walked with us today. Don't let this be the end of it. This is the beginning. There are people in this country, there are people in this world who are trying to stop the voice of the oppressed being heard. Let us make that voice even louder today. I want you to shout with me so that everyone can hear this. Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Say it again, free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Let them hear it loud and clear across the world today. Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
The voice of the oppressed will not go unheard, and we're here to make sure that they will not go unheard. This is just the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. We're really running out of time. I've just been asked for squeezing one more speaker who's with me now, who is a Palestinian. After all, their voice must be heard. So a big round of applause for our last speaker this afternoon.
Salaamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. Thank you very much. There isn't much really that I could talk about really more than my colleagues, but there are three messages that we would like really to have with us when we go today. The first one really is the continued support for your brothers and sisters and children in Palestine. Don't leave them. The demonstrations are enough. We need more than this. The second message really is the education in the cause of Palestine. We need to educate each other in the cause of Palestine. The war in Palestine is not really a war as people actually only say it. It's a genocide. It's a massacre against all the children. The war is really going against the children, against the civilians, against the women that they are actually bare. They cannot defend themselves. And this is what you see. Now, I would like just to let you know just few facts about Gaza. And I will talk about it just only from the medical point of view. Gaza has only 13 hospitals. And imagine how many beds are there in Gaza. There are only 1,500 beds, 1,500 beds in Gaza. How many have been wounded so far? More than 2,200, more than 2,200 have been wounded. How many IC units there? Less than 10 intensive care units there. What's going on? The people are really buried when they are actually bombed. They are actually, even they cannot find the way to get buried. So we need your support in the message of really education of the cause of Palestine. And don't forget as well that any penny that you put for the support of your brothers and your sisters and your beloved children in Palestine is going to be rewarded. These are your brothers in humanity. Please don't forget them. Free Palestine! Free Palestine!
We're going to have to wrap up, folks. A few quick announcements. Obviously, we're being driven by world events here right now. Israel is threatening a land invasion. So the vigil on the centre, on the spot opposite the Hippodrome behind me now, 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock every weekday afternoon to catch the rush hour traffic. We've been getting a huge amount of support from passing cars, almost a constant blare of horns being sounded in support of the peace vigil, and there's been 30 to 70 people there various nights this week, and we're going to have to keep that up because Israel is threatening a land invasion. And while they keep that threat hanging over the people of Gaza, we've got to be down here protesting and keeping up the pressure. Finally, there's those postcards to MPs. We haven't got enough to fill a sack yet, so please come over and sign those postcards. Get in touch, there's free literature. We don't want to have to take any of it home with us this afternoon. And finally, one more. Let's hear the chant for Palestine now. You've all been modest, you've turned out in large numbers. Please come back in the week with more friends. So, free, free Palestine!
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 Well done, well done!
My name's Dr. Judith Brown. I'm an advisor to Arab Media Watch, and I've done a PhD which looked at media imagery in the British media, the images of Arabs in the British media.
Now, this demonstration is specifically about the bombing of Gaza this Christmas 2008-2009. How has the media treatment of that been, in your view?
Well, I haven't been here for except for the last 2 days. Most of the time, I've actually been in Yemen, listening to the Arab media in Yemen, and found that they've been giving very full coverage of the situation in Gaza for the last 3 months, the siege. And so, when it came to the bombing of Israel by Israel of Gaza, people understood it very well. And, for example, one Yemeni lady said to me, "We love America, we love Britain, we want peace with Israel. Why are they doing this to the people of Gaza?" So people sort of like understood it in a completely different way. And when I came back to England just 2 days ago, it was almost as if there was a completely different situation because the sympathies were sort of like directed in a different direction. There is some sympathy with sort of Palestinian people, but there's underreporting and an unawareness of like the whole sort of build-up to the situation before the bombing happened. And
so one of the most important things is the language used, isn't it? And can you say how that might be different in the Arab world and in the sort of NATO zone?
Yeah. Well, in the Arab world, certainly there is a big difference because they are using words like occupation, they're describing people as martyrs, they're talking about sort of the oppression. They see it as a sort of like Israel as a colonist, as an experience of colonization. And this is totally misunderstood in the West. I know that, for example, Greg Pilo's studies from Glasgow University actually showed that people didn't even understand the term occupation. Of course, in Britain, that's very difficult. We haven't been occupied since 1066. So people thought it was like being locked in a toilet rather than sort of, you know, occupation, being a military occupation where you take control of people's lives lives by sort of military occupation, and people can't understand how that sort of restricts everything that you do, even to the extent of who you marry or how you bring your children up. Everything's controlled, and people who haven't had experience of that, of course, they can't understand it at all, and it's alien to the understanding of the British people, and that is constantly sort of like reflected in the media, and it becomes something that perpetuates, because the people who are listening to our media today, of course, in Britain, are going to be the people who are reporting for the media and managing the media in the next generation. And so the story sort of like continues to go on. And so people such as ourselves who've had opportunity of visiting the Arab world, working in the Arab world, making friends with the Arab world, and listening to two different discourses and two different points of view, we can actually look in two directions and maybe feel that we've got a lot to offer. But the difficulty is that although you feel that you've a lot to offer by saying, well, you look at it this way, the other person looks at it the other way, the difficulty is that because you're not speaking the language that everyone understands, you're seen as a very irrational and extremist person, and people sort of think, oh, well, Judith would say that, wouldn't she? She's brainwashed by our Arab friends. No sort of like understanding of the fact that I'm actually really trying to explain that there's that truth isn't absolute, just depending on which direction you come from. Truth can be sort of like very, very different.
Well, and we've heard the word war used. Yeah. And I mean, I can see that there may be some questions over whether really this is a war going on between Hamas and Israel.
Yes, and I think that if you look at the media in Yemen, for example, there you saw this sort of like oppression sort of like building up and building up and building up, and so you saw an oppressed people who were being more and more and more oppressed until it got to the point where bombs were actually falling. So there people didn't see it as sort of like as a war, they saw it as an oppressive and aggressive action against which people were resisting. It's a very different scenario to these, almost like the equality, you know, where they say, oh, Israel's dropped some bombs on Gaza and Hamas has fired two rockets into Israel, as making it sound almost as if it's an equal situation. Also, when they reported the killing on the news, for example, this morning, they didn't report anything about children killed, but what they reported was that a Hamas leader had been killed, as if that was the only person that had been killed by the Israeli bombing. It's the perspective is skewed, and but as I say, the people who are feeding on this now, the current generation, the people who are school children now, the people who are studying, they're going to accept that as their truth and perpetuate it through to the next generation.
So how does anybody, as a bit of an expert on this, anybody that's seeing the news and maybe a little bit scratching their head a bit skeptically, what is the best way to read between the lines, between the headlines?
Well, I think it's very difficult to read through the headlines unless you've actually got some background information. And I mean, for me personally, I was just really shocked the first time I went to work in South Lebanon in 1995, because I saw a situation that I wasn't expecting when I saw Israeli occupation at first hand. I'd always believed that, you know, the right people had won the Six-Day War, and I was just as naive as other British people. So I think that first of all there has to be a good educational program, and so for people to understand sort of some of the facts, because you can't read through the news if you don't have any sort of like basic understanding of what the reality of the situation is. And I just feel myself that I'm very fortunate in having witnessed at first hand a different situation.
Can you recommend us, because we're on the internet, can you recommend some websites to go to for news as an alternative to, say, you know, sitting watching the telly on the 10 o'clock news?
A very good website is Arab Media Watch, which not only gives you some advice on how you can sort of like counteract and influence some of the issues relating to not just Palestine and Israel, but all Arab issues, but it actually gives quite a lot of background information on that website. So if you look at the country in question, in this case Palestine and Israel, you can actually find out the sort of like the basic facts written in quite a concise and organised way on that website. And I think it's the best website in order to get information from.
So where do you get your daily news from? Do you get it from the ordinary TV, or do you get it from elsewhere?
Well, I get a lot of my news. I actually get from I'm on various email lists, and I get sort of information on email lists also from friends who live in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, and so forth. Yes. I mean, for one thing, if they join the Bristol PSC lists, they actually get Palestine Today on a daily basis. They have sort of headline news come up, and so if they join our Bristol PSC list, they can get the headlines that are actually reported by a Lebanese who every day, sort of as a complete volunteer, scans the news all over the world and picks out sort of interesting alternative news sites.
Okay, so how do you join that list then?
Well, you can get in touch with the Bristol Palestine Solidarity. You can look that up, Bristol Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. You can get in touch with the National Palestine Campaign, and they will direct you to Bristol, and then you can go onto our email list, or you can contact someone like Roland, who's here today, and he might be able to give you a telephone number of someone that you can contact to actually go directly onto the list.
Dr. Judith Brown ending that report on the Bristol Gaza Solidarity March by Tony Gosling.
And there are two things coming up in Bristol in support of the situation in Palestine. First of all is on this coming Friday. At 2:30 outside Lloyd's TSB Bank in Corn Street, people will be gathering because Lloyd's have closed the bank account of Palestinian aid charity Interpal. So that's Friday at 2:30 at Lloyd's TSB on Corn Street. Also on Wednesday the 28th of January, there'll be a teach-in about Palestine and Israel. That's at Broadmead Baptist Church, Union Street in central Bristol, 7 p.m. Wednesday 28th of January. And the web address for the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign is uk.groups.yahoo.com/group/Bristol-PSC. And that's the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
George Galloway, MP, has been organising support for the people of Gaza and yet hasn't been asked to appear on British TV or radio to discuss the crisis. So here he is, speaking last week.
The BBC, which we called the Bush and Blair Corporation during the run-up to the Iraq War, has become the English language arm of the Israeli Defence Force during this invasion. And, let me appeal to the journalists, the decent journalists in the BBC, to insist that those who are keeping the journalists out of the Gaza Strip are not allowed to dictate the terms of reference made by the BBC. Israel is not targeting Hamas militants in Gaza. How can a warship barking its lead and fire onto a beach and beyond be said to be targeting anything? How could a tank, which were first used in the First World War and whose essential armament has not changed, it raises its barrel and it fires. How could an artillery piece, equally using essentially the same targeting as it did a century or more ago, be said to be targeting anything? And how can anybody be said to be targeting when more than 300 women and children have been killed so far in this murderous bombardment of Gaza? And why is every Palestinian fighter a militant? As has been said, these people are the legitimate armed forces of the elected government of Palestine. As for their tunnels, Well, they wouldn't need tunnels if they were receiving right off the assembly lines of the arms manufacturers of the United States and Great Britain the latest armory to muzzle people with. And I want to talk about the government too. Those of you who have seen some of the internet traffic today will know that we're locked yet again with a government minister who doesn't want us to walk on the grass in the Royal Park at Kensington Gardens. You'll remember Tessa Jowell before the February 15th demonstration, the biggest in British history, said that we couldn't get into Hyde Park because we might damage the grass. Somebody called Andy Burnham, unlikely I know as the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport in this country, says no, we can't enter Kensington Gardens because it's a royal park. Well, as I said to Tessa Jowell back then, you could choose. You can have a million people in Hyde Park, or you can have a million angry people on the streets of London instead. The British government understands the terrifying risks that it is running with the policy that it is pursuing. You've heard me say here before, they're always looking for some Muslim cleric to ban, some Muslim organization to proscribe, some hapless imam to blame for the radicalization of Muslim youth. How radical do you think Muslims in Britain are feeling after two whole weeks of watching this slaughter in Palestine?
That was the one and only George Galloway MP there with his unique take on the Gaza crisis. He keeps his Talk Sport show on Friday and Saturday evenings on Medium Wave. Now it's time to hear from a man called Bill Nash. He served in Palestine for several years in the British Army before the Israeli state was created. And here he is, talking to Dialect Radio's Tony Gosling.
My name is Bill Nash. I was called up in 1945 and sent to Palestine in, as a young officer, 1946, August, just after the King David explosion, I think it was. And I was stationed in Jerusalem. Beautiful climate, lovely place. But the terrorist organisation were just beginning to start up there to get rid of us and get the mandate taken away, or us to give up the mandate, rather. And it was a nice country, but it wasn't a pleasant time because we were largely confined to camp because of the terrorist activities. Wasn't much one could do about it. But it was something, as a national serviceman, one had to bear. And I didn't leave it until after they handed over. England gave up the mandate in, I think it was 47, 48, and we stayed on with one brigade in Haifa to get all our stores out while the United Nations ran the rest of the country and the war started.
So why were you in your garrison rather than out there stopping the terrorists, the Israeli terrorists?
I don't think it's something you can go out to deal with. You have to wait until things happen, generally, or do searches all the time and keep troops off the roads and keep them in barracks, because they're not targets then. If the more they're out, the more they're exposed they are. Unless you're on a definite operation where you're looking, you have information and intelligence that are the terrorists in a certain place. It's very difficult. This was particularly difficult. These people are very clever, and the nation was behind them because they just lost 6 million in Europe, and they felt that they were entitled to have this little spot in the Mediterranean, and we shouldn't be interfering with it. Unfortunately, the mandate was ours, and we had to see that fair play between Arabs and Jews took place, and that we couldn't support either side. We didn't certainly want to go against the Arabs because they had the oil, and we couldn't do anything about the Jews because they just had this dreadful experience in Europe.
So what was there a sort of balance then of a bit of Arab terrorism and a bit of Jewish terrorism?
No, the Arab terrorism had taken place before the war. This was after the war, and it was all, and these people were all trained by all the terrorists. Most of them had been trained by the armed forces, either British or the Americans, in the war. So they were experienced people, and they were very able and intelligent.
You mentioned at the start the King David Hotel. Can you tell us about that? Because that's, I think, one of the best known attacks.
Yes, that was the first big thing that happened. I mean, it was just starting then, and security was very lax in the hotel, and a handful of them just came and went into the basement and placed a bomb there and set it off. It was a very easy job to do. They were surprised. And that started off, and then from then on it was rather much tighter. I was stationed in Jerusalem just after that, and I'd been to the officers' club down in downtown Jerusalem. I was living in Allenby Barracks, and I thought the officers' club would be a very nice place to live. There was a beautiful Jewish girl there on the reception. And I thought this could be very pleasant, so I planned to move in on the Friday. On the Thursday, it was blown up, and I was on the court of inquiry. And it's quite amazing, the people that escaped, people standing on the first floor above the bomb, two officers talking, and the explosion went between them, and they were both deafened, but perfectly all right, whereas people sleeping on the second floor were killed. And two officers on the roof who were sunbathing came down with the roof and just walked off the ruins, and perfectly, not a scratch on them. But the poor Jewish girl, I mean, there was a picture of her being carried out in a stretcher with her head off, and two soldiers who were carrying her were vomiting to one side. It's appalling business.
So that was which attack again?
That was on the officers' club after the King David. But it was going on all the time after that. It was just a constant thing.
Wasn't there really an attempt, though, by the British to make sure that there was some form of power sharing between the Jewish and the Arabs?
It wasn't a question. I don't think there was any problem about that. I think the Jews were being quite sensible in that respect. They said, look, if we get this, you'll have the same vote as anybody else to the Arabs resident there. They'd been living side by side for a couple of thousand years with no problems. The problem started when the political wing of the Jewish people, the Zionists, decided that they wanted a state of their own, and they decided on that spot. And of course you get the people whipped up. I mean, if you were Jewish, of course, having had what you've had in Europe, we can't go on like we were. We have to have our own country to defend our interests, and this was the site selected for historic reasons, and so they were dedicated to it, and nothing we could do about it. They said to the Arabs we would give you one vote each, but the Arabs decided no, they didn't want that. Because what I used to say to the servants in the mess and so on, you know, well, you chaps would go along with this. I didn't know much about it, only 19. But I said, they've done wonders in the parts of the country that they're occupying. It was green, they were growing fertile land, they were growing oranges, it was becoming little bits of prosperity. And I said, well, go along with these people, you'll do very well. They said, no, British, leave Palestine, all Jews dead 1 week. And they would cross their throats, you know. I said, what could you do? Madness on both sides. But
so tell us about when the British finally pulled out. Can you describe that?
Well, that went very quietly. We just, all our stores were pushed into Haifa, the port there, and we kept one brigade there. And it took us about a month to clear it. We took an interest in us then, because we were out of it. We were no longer in the country, and we just had this little port. And neither side took an interest on us, but there was still a little bit of trouble between them, and the Jews notified the brigade command at one stage that they were going to clear the old city, part of the city, out the next morning, because they'd been having trouble with them. And so the brigade command had to make a quick decision as to what to do, try and get in between or what. But we decided it was futile, so we left it. And by 6:30 the next morning, they were all gone, floating out to sea in little boats. And it was quiet after that. They blew a flour mill up after that, and they were walking around looking as if they'd just dumped out of a sack of flour like ghosts for about a week. But after that, there was nothing much of interest. The odd shot fired, but nothing.
Now, a lot of people are talking about wanting some sort of political renewal here in Britain. Do you feel that as well, or is that, do you think, not necessary?
I think we need a complete renewal. I think democracy is getting a bit rickety. There's no most businesses and in other areas of our existence are being new innovations are coming in, new ideas. But in politics and running a democracy, there seems to be nothing doing. Same old thing, tax, spend. We really need to start having a new view of the whole thing. It's very difficult. I find that I don't vote because there's no political party has anything that I want in their manifestos. I mean, this is three parties here. None of them have. If they had about four or five things that I want, I would go out and vote. But they don't, and they get away with it. I don't think anybody would vote for uncontrolled immigration, which we have now. I don't think anybody wants any immigration, but up to 60 billion. And I've always said I think 35 is the ideal number of people to be living here, the reasonable standard of living. It's a very uncomfortable existence. The roads are clogged. There's queues for so much. Everything's overcrowded. And there's so many people here who seem to be starting to be unfriendly towards us.
What about any other things other than immigration as an issue which you think would actually excite people and get them to vote for one of the three existing political parties or else some other political party?
I think that there should be a cap on spending by any government. I think if we ran the place as we did Hong Kong from 1950 until when it was a refugee camp of 3 million people with no raw materials, no coal, no oil, nothing. We had to import our vegetables. Even our water had to be imported. And a small administration, reasonably efficient, reasonably incorrupt, brought it inside of 40 years in the 1990s when I left and when the Chinese took over into the 12th greatest trading nation in the world. Not city, but greatest trading nation in the world. America first and so on. Now, the reason for that was that they had a man called Cowperthwaite, who was our financial secretary, Sir John Cowperthwaite, who set up a system of taxation and running the economy that was 15% corporations tax, 16% personal income tax, no tax on dividends, no capital gains tax, inheritance tax, nothing really, nothing else that. And no statistics to come out from government because they said they would be manipulated by government if they had them. And by God, on that simple basis, we went to the 12th greatest trading nation in the world inside 40-odd years. I'd like to see is that on talking about the controlling expenditure is that if they want to bring taxation above 15 or 16%, they should have a referendum among the people and get a 75% vote. We agree you have to tax it because of the war or some other emergency. But other than that, they have no way of increasing expenditure or increasing taxation so that You can elect a bunch of chimpanzees into power, and you don't have to worry about it. Your money's not going to be taken away from you, or your house is not going to be overtaxed, or this, that, and the other. You don't have to worry about what they do. Now they're interfering in every facet of our lives.
Thank you very much to Bill Nash for his contribution and for Tony Gosling for his efforts. Here is Mungo Jerry.
Rock, 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 rock
that was Mungo Jerry. I would say, well, whatever happened to him? But based on that evidence, I'm not sure many people are really going to care. He did once famously sing, "Have a drink, have a drive, and see what we can find." A breathalyzer test, probably. Governor Blagojevich of Illinois has been impeached. But what has he been up to deserve this? Well, here he is speaking to a group of workers occupying a Chicago factory just before he was impeached. So let's find out.
We have contacted all of our agencies across state government, and as of now, every agency has been ordered to suspend doing any business with the Bank of America. The Bank of America received $25 billion in taxpayer money as part of the financial bailout. This is exactly and precisely the kind of thing that isn't right when, on the one hand, powerful special interests get the help of taxpayer money to bail them out, the banks, and yet the purpose of that money was supposed to be to provide a line of credit to businesses like this to keep workers working and keep people employed. And yet the Bank of America has yet to step up and say that they're going to be helpful to this company and keep these workers working. So unless and until they do that, we, the state of Illinois, will suspend doing any business with the Bank of America. And we hope that this kind of leverage and pressure will encourage the Bank of America to do the right thing for this business, take some of that federal tax money that they've received, and invest it by providing the necessary credit to this company so these workers can keep their jobs. Secondly, we are preparing a temporary restraining order, a TRO, and we are going into court tomorrow to seek an injunction by a federal judge to assure that the provisions of the federal law, the Warren Act, are followed so that these workers who are facing who have faced now the loss of their jobs will at least have the opportunity to get the benefits that they're entitled to under federal law: severance pay, vacation days, all the different things that the Warren Act provides. These workers have a right to, they're entitled to. So we're going into court tomorrow to enforce that provision and get them the help they need. Third, we are also working with the Chicago Food Depository to see if we can get a delivery of food to the workers and their families so that during this period where they're not working or in a position to be able to afford the help that they need for their families, that they can get some help and have some food available to be able to feed themselves and their families and their children. So these are the acts that we're taking now. We're going to continue to work in conjunction with some of our efforts. Congressman Luis Gutierrez has been a real champion on the side of these workers, and I've been in constant communication with him, and we'll continue to discuss things with him as events unfold. This 4 o'clock meeting that Carl referenced is one that Congressman Gutierrez is going to be at, and he's going to report to me on the progress of that meeting. But let me be very clear here. We are going to do everything possible here in Illinois to side with these workers. And it isn't just lending them moral support, but it's about putting pressure on financial institutions like the Bank of America, as well as making sure that we have our court system enforce the federal law so these workers get what they're entitled to under the law and under what is the right thing to do.
People realize that workers have been being stepped on for too long, and that we can't get our economy going again if we keep just dumping workers out, and if we don't pay workers enough to buy back the goods and services that they produce. And we understand that's what why this fight is attracting so much attention. But this fight is also about a very specific problem here, about these workers at this time whose plant is closed, and that there are powerful and wealthy institutions that have to make decisions about, are they going to make the effort to get this facility going again, to have the green jobs here that are supposed to be the future of our country, Energy Star windows produced here. Are they going to make that happen, or are they not going to make that happen? And if it doesn't happen, are they going to make sure that the workers get all of the wages and benefits that they are promised under the law?
Well, you heard Governor Blagojevich there. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. It's worth pointing out, of course, that he's been in the news for being impeached, but they haven't really highlighted in the press the fact that he wanted the state of Illinois to boycott the Bank of America. And you heard all about that there from himself, from his own lips. Our reporter, Anthea Page, is in Peru at the moment, and via the wonders of email, she sent us this report on the Inca Museum last week.
My name is Ilia Alemán. I work in the Andean Sanctuaries Museum. It's a museum that is located in Arequipa, in Peru, in the southern part of our country. And here we have an exhibition about the Inca culture.
Can you tell us that when the Incas ruled, what period in history?
Well, the best period of the Incas was probably in the 14th century. But the culture was here conforming a government approximately 200 or 300 years before. They were conquering another regions in South America, and well, the capital of the Inca government was here in Peru. And it's one of the most developed civilizations that we had in the world, like China, India, Egypt, and the Mayas in Mexico.
So can you tell us a bit about Juanita?
Juanita is a frozen girl that was found in the highest mountain that we have in the area of the Colca Valley, that is the deepest canyon of the whole world. Juanita was sacrificed because of the eruption of a volcano, and she was found on the top of the highest peak of that region.
Oh, what's the height of that mountain? It's pretty high, isn't it?
Yes, well, in meters, it's 6,380 meters above the sea level. And she was found on the top, as I told you, of that mountain. And, well, she was sacrificed because of the eruption of a volcano in the area. The agriculture there was affected by the eruption of that volcano. And in that years, the Incas considered that was a consequence of the fury of their gods, the gods of the mountains, no? Because they believed in the gods of the nature, the sun, the moon. The power of the mountains also was important for them. And that's why that Juanita was sacrificed like another children in another volcanoes in South America. But the outstanding of her is that Juanita is the best preserved body that was found until today. She's only frozen, no? Like the Ötzi in Austria. Well, Juanita is in South America the best preserved body. And, well, we have her on display in this museum in a special case with minus 20 degrees Celsius of temperature. That is more or less the same kind of conditions that Juanita had on the mountain.
Because we actually saw the body this morning, didn't we? We said good morning to Juanita.
Yes. Well, the people that works with her, well, including me, we feel completely identified with her. We feel a lot of respect because she's not only a part of our past. It's real that we were influenced by the Spanish and other cultures later, but we have an important part of our culture is still Indian, no? We still keep a part of our typical native customs, and that's why that Juanita is very important for us. It's part of our background, historical background.
Can you tell us how she was killed?
Yes, Juanita was blown to the head with an object called macana. It's a kind of a star made of stone that the Incas used in the wars, that was specifically used to send the child in a fast way to the afterlife to protect the rest of the people. No?
Can you describe what she was wearing when she was killed?
Well, she was using a shawl. A shawl above her shoulder,
This is in the museum, isn't it? Her clothing.
Yes, exactly, exactly. We have on display all of her textiles. Part of them were removed from her body. For example, the shawl, no, and well, the rest of her clothing was a large dress, no, everything made of alpaca and cotton. And dyed with vegetal and another natural dyes that were used by the Incas. The colors are intact until today, and it's also one of the interesting things that we show in the museum, no? The way that the Incas knew the possibilities to obtain all of these materials from the nature to make dyes, to make the pottery, and the rest of the other accessories that were used in the ritual.
Can you just describe her hat? Because that was quite amazing, wasn't it? The hat that she was found with.
Well, the feathers hat that was usually worn by these children was not found with Juanita because she was not found in her grave.
Oh, she fell, didn't she?
She fell into the crater of the volcano because of an earthquake that we had in the Colca Valley. And she lost part of her offerings in the way, especially the organic materials. And that's why the feathers were destroyed. But in the few offerings that were found in her burial, was possible to identify a feather's hat also. And in another mummies, in another volcanoes, our archaeologists found also the feather's hat complete. And that's why that we are sure that she was wearing the same.
Then can you tell us about a bit about her background, how she was chosen from other children?
Well, we have many historical documents that talk about the way that the Incas choose these children. They had the custom to select the people in the different regions that were conquered by them, and then they choose the most beautiful children of all of these regions.
For sacrifice
them, yes, exactly. And, well, Juanita was probably the most beautiful girl of her region. And, well, we have also another theory that she could be part of the noble class of the Incas because of the kind of textiles that were found with her, with the typical colors of the elite of the Incas, because of the size of her accessories in the dress. And the most important for us is the location of her grave on the mountain, on the top. Another children were found on the same volcano, but in a lower altitude. And we are not sure the reasons, you know, about the reasons that Incas had to make that difference. But probably it's because of the importance of that girl.
And didn't they mark the graves with a ring of stones? That's how they found it, wasn't it?
Exactly. Well, in the majority of these graves, it's possible to find a ring or sometimes a rectangle made of stones that is considered a mark, you know, the sign that the Incas left for the gods to identify the place of the offering.
Now they think there's a lot more bodies up there, don't they?
Yes.
That they haven't found yet.
Exactly. Well, in total we have 14 bodies in this museum. Not all of them are on display because we try to make an exhibition like a sanctuary, no? And we try to keep their respect about Juanita. No, well, the others are here in another kind of special cases with also a low temperature to keep them well preserved. No, another four were found in Argentina also with the help of the same project, but they belong to that country and that's why that they are not here. But we are sure that we have more bodies like her or probably better preserved than Juanita underneath the snow of our mountains. And that's the main interest of the project, no? Yeah. To rescue all of our archaeological materials, to rescue also our past.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to Anthea Page, and we look forward to hearing a little bit more about the Inca culture and what she's up to in Peru. But now time for the excellently and comfortably cardiganed Jeff Sparks for this week's What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 16th of January, and at the Fleece in Bristol, the 10-piece soul covers group On the Edge will be performing. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Moving on to Saturday, 17th of January, and at the Farrier's Arms in Fishponds Road, Bristol, The Woods will be performing. Entry is free and the gigs should start around 9 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Willie Nelson. This is from the album Legend, The Best of Willie Nelson, and this is the track Highwayman, which also features Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, and Kris Kristofferson.
I was a highwayman, along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive.
I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico. I went aloft to furl the mainsail in a blow. And when the yards broke off, they said that I got killed. But I'm living still.
I was a dam builder across a river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. A place called Boulder on the Wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that gray tomb that knows no sound, but I'm still around. I'll always be around, around and around. I fly a starship across the universe divide, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again, or I may simply be a single drop of rain. But I will remain, and I'll be back again and again and again and again and again and again.
That was the track Highwayman by Willie Nelson from the album Legend, The Best of Willie Nelson. For more information on Willie Nelson, check out www.willienelson.com. Keeping with Saturday 17th of January, and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, the exhibition will be performing with support from Familiar Looking Strangers. Now, the exhibition feature ex-members of the group Halo, who split it up in 2003. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £2 in advance and £3 on the door. Also on 17th of January, and at Area 81 in Lawrence Hill, Bristol, Clockwork Sniper will be performing with support from Too Close to Hate, Hope Remains Lost and Atrium Riot. Doors open at 9 p.m. and check with the venue about entry price. Finally, on 18th of January and at the Coronation Tap in Bristol, Mike Willox and Co. will be performing. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff Sparks. I always do treasure the counterpoint of such a comfortable voice entering such acts as Atrium Riot and Too Close to Hate. Well, that's all for this week's show. A little bit of news about next week. We've finished our serialisation of Cider with Rosie, no more. But next week, we've got a first episode of the new serialisation. It's the history of the world of the Mafia. Dialect is a community internet radio station, broadcast on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and at bcfm.org.uk, and as well as on the BCFM airwaves at 93.2 across the city of Bristol, and also across the city of Preston, I understand, recently as well. Hello Preston, shout out. One time. Dialects is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. Well, this is the hip-hop lingo, you've got to get down with the kids on the radio. And anyone can contribute, so if you'd like to, either in reporting or on the engineering side, please do get in touch by volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And you can come along for any reason, if you're just curious, really. You don't have to sort of come with a set agenda, you can just come watch and see what you can contribute. Reported this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and thank you to Jeff Sparks for his weekly What Song Guide and Song of the Week. Thank you also to Bill Nash for his contributions for helping us out, and to Judith Brown. The producer was Tony Gosling, that was Dalek Radio, and this is John Peters Coleman wishing you a very good week. From all the team in our Queen Square studio, thank you for joining us and goodbye.